check, 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 check one. Let's get the show on the road. Good evening. Welcome to the second installment of Let's Rock and Roll. I'm your host, DJ Trouble, and I can't wait for my classic soul to share some classic rock knowledge with all you every Monday night on radio.dominican.edu, the official radio station of Dominican University of California. Each week, I will be telling you about a legendary band from the classic rock era. We're talking 60s and 70s here. They'll have the baby boomers feeling nostalgic and the newer generations ready to discover something old, yet something brand new. This week, we'll be jamming together to the band that doesn't quit after five decades, the Rolling Stones. Now, the two foundational members of this legendary band that we're going to talk about tonight are lead singer Mick Jagger and lead guitarist Keith Richards. Jagger and Richards have been best friends since childhood growing up outside of London, England. Jagger and his family moved away, and the two didn't speak until 1960, when they were around 17 years old, when they were reacquainted at a local train station. That seems to happen a lot in researching these classic rock bands. The two bonded over their music tastes. Naturally, at the time, this was 1960s, so what was popular was Chuck Berry, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, very early foundational rock and roll that was based heavily on the blues, which influenced multiple bands in the 1960s. A year later, the boys would create a band together along with Jagger's friend, Dick Taylor, and two others. They would call themselves the Blues Boys. Not to be confused with the SNL parody band and future legendary blues band, the Blues Brothers. The Blues Boys visited a jazz club called the Ealing Jazz Club in 1962 to see the London-based rhythm and blues band, Blues Incorporated, which included three future Rolling Stones members, guitarist Brian Jones, keyboardist Ian Stewart, and drummer Charlie Watts. Jones became the leader in promoting the band, even being credited for naming the band the Rolling Stones after a Muddy Waters song. Literally, what happened was he was lying around and the guys were asking, oh, what should we name this band? The Blues Boys kind of sounds generic. And he finds this Muddy Waters record that says the Rolling Stone. And, oh, that sounds good. Let's just call it the Rolling Stones. And let's just stick with it. It definitely worked out. By the summer of 1962, the Rolling Stones were set and ready to be marketed into the world of music. Bassist Bill Wyman replaced Dick Taylor in late 1962, and Charlie Watts officially joined in 1963. These two would create the consistent rhythm section that would hold the Rolling Stones together for decades. When you think of the Rolling Stones, you think of Mick Jagger's dance moves and his vocal and his facial expressions where he looks like a T-Rex sometimes. And then, even then, you might think of Keith Richards as the drug addict or the guy who can play a really mean guitar, but no one really gives credit to the bass and the drums. They're really the glue when you create a band. That's what keeps the songs going. The band's first gig was at the Marquee Club in London that year, and the Stones soon gained a reputation for bringing back the blues. Similar to the Beatles, management wanted to sell the Rolling Stones to American audiences for revenue. Bands are usually a byproduct. The fans usually come later and learn to appreciate the music, but when they gotta start, you gotta sell them in order to get people to know about them. As a result, Ian Stewart was kicked out of the band by management, although the Rolling Stones loved him enough, so they kept him around to become their road manager until his death in 1985. The band signed with Decca Records, and the marketing of the band took full, instantaneous swing. The Rolling Stones' manager, Andrew Oldham, advertised the band as the threat to the Beatles. When the Beatles were being promoted, as I mentioned last week, they were promoted as four clean lads from Liverpool with nice mop head haircuts and dressed in very nice and tight suits. That's what their manager, Brian Epstein, wanted to present them as to promote them to a preteen audience and make sure the parents approved of them as well. The Rolling Stones did not want to go in that direction. Instead, the Stones were sexualized as the Bad Boys, with provocative headlines next to them such as, "Would you let your daughter marry a Rolling Stone?" My personal answer? No, because I'd marry a Rolling Stone. I would, but a little tricky now. They were the first big band to ever take this approach and truly embody rock and roll from the very beginning. We see sexualizing of artists everywhere in today's society, but rather than a physical approach to it, such as the skimpy outfits and the bare chest, more skin, more money, the Rolling Stones just never wore matching suits and haircuts like the Beatles and other bands of the British Invasion did. That was it. They just wore regular clothes and grew out their hair the way they wanted to, and this was seen as an act of rebellion. Well, the Rolling Stones weren't buying the be squeaky clean sort of gig. They really wanted their fans to listen to their music. It's really funny how perceptions change 50 years later. The Stones released singles that were covers of their favorite artists, such as Chuck Berry's Come On, their first single, Buddy Holly's Not Fade Away, and even the Beatles' I Wanna Be Your Man. The Rolling Stones went on their first U.S. tour in 1964, which Bill Wyman referred to as a disaster. By this time, the Rolling Stones were huge in the United States, quite possibly even bigger than the Beatles in terms of pandemonium. Even though the Beatles were the most popular band at the time, the Rolling Stones had a fair share of their fans as well. By this time, the Rolling Stones obviously were huge in the United States, but they were so huge, Ed Sullivan had to ban them from his show because of the crazy crowds that would stack outside of his studio. They were just causing a ruckus. And Ed Sullivan didn't like the way the Rolling Stones were presented because they didn't have that squeaky clean image, and they had songs that suggested some sexual undertone, such as Let's Spend the Night Together. A year later, when they released that single, Ed Sullivan requested that they change the refrain of Let's Spend the Night Together to Let's Spend Some Time Together to cater to his audience. They didn't. So in February 1965, The Last Time reached number one in the UK charts, the first Jagger Richards compilation to reach the charts. That'll be the first Stone song you'll hear tonight. Listen for the distinct guitar from Keith Richards blended with the unique vocals from Mick Jagger, something that would become a trademark for years to come. This is DJ Treble, and you're listening to Let's Rock and Roll on Penguin Radio.
This
welcome back to Let's Rock and Roll on Penguin Radio. I'm your host, DJ Treble. 3 months after the release of that song, The Last Time, the Rolling Stones released I Can't Get No Satisfaction, which remains one of the most well-known Rolling Stones songs today. Trust me, your kids will probably know this song, even though they probably don't know the Rolling Stones off the top of their head. They would probably know this song. Keith Richards actually envisioned the song to have a horn section to play alongside the guitars. Instead of, like, the guitar riff that's in your head right now, imagine that with a horn section. That would sound really cool. The version that is played on every rock station is without the horns, because the manager, Andrew Oldham, released the version without the horns to, again, market to his audience. I always appreciate Keith's musical creativity, and I really could have wished I'd heard this version. 1966 was the year the Stones would release Aftermath, the first album to feature Jagger Richards compilations. One of the songs that you'll hear in a moment is off this album, Paint It Black. Released as a single in May of 1966, you'll hear Brian Jones on the sitar, an Indian instrument also incorporated by George Harrison from the Beatles in a few songs. You're listening to Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Treble on radio.dominican.edu.
I see a line of cars and they are painted black, with flowers and my love hope never to come back.
I see people turn their heads and quickly look away, like a newborn baby, it just happens every day.
I look inside myself and see my heart. I see my red door, I must have it into black.
Maybe then I'll fade away and not have to face the facts. It's not easy facing up when your whole world is black.
No more will my green seagull turn a deeper blue. I could not foresee this thing happening to you.
If I look hard enough into the setting sun, my love will laugh with me before the morning comes. I see a red door and I want it painted black. No colors anymore. I have to turn my head until my darkness goes.
Welcome back, rock and rollers. You're listening to Let's Rock and Roll with your host, DJ Treble, on Penguin Radio on radio.dominican.edu. I hope you're enjoying this Rolling Stones hour, because we're about to get in the thick of things here. In 1967, the band would develop the reputation as being one of the most first bands to be under suspicion by police about their drug use. British tabloid magazine News of the World ran a three-part feature called Pop Stars and Drugs, Facts That Will Shock You. The series exposed LSD parties hosted by the Moody Blues, another British band at the time, and attended by Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Brian Jones, as well as The Who's Pete Townsend, another band I'll be covering this semester, The Who, and singer Donovan. A week after the story was released, British police raided the home of Keith Richards for drugs. Now, this will not be the first time his home will be raided for drugs. No arrest was made, but Jagger and Richards were charged with drug offenses. Along with the drug use, the deterioration of Brian Jones became prominent when Jones's girlfriend left him for Richards during a trip to Morocco. She and Richards would go on to date for 12 years. Talk about shade. By the middle of 1967, 3 out of 5 members of the band were dealing with drug charges. Jagger, Richards, and Jones. Yeah, they definitely lived up to their bad boy reputation. But by the end of 1967, the charges for possession of marijuana were dropped or reduced for all three of them, and the band would record and release their new album, Their Satanic Majesty's Request, in December. The album is described as the band's version of Sgt. Pepper, because this is during 1967, the album was just released a month before, and everyone wanted to emulate Sgt. Pepper because it was just so revolutionary at the time. With that prevalent psychedelic sound and the colorful cover art, anyone would have copied the Beatles at the time. After the album, however, 1968 arrived, and Keith Richards decided to go against the hippie counterculture and channel his emotions felt during the drug charges into the next album. Keith Richards is definitely a musical genius, definitely an artist in his craft. This idea became Beggar's Banquet, released in 1968, which I like to call the first definitive Rolling Stones album. Because you have songs like Street Finding Man, Jumpin' Jack Flash, and Sympathy for the Devil, which are constantly played on the radio. And they're constantly played on classic rock radio. That's all I have to say about that. I find this album enjoyable because it sounds purely like the Rolling Stones as a serious rock band. Like I've said, this really defines their sound, at least in 1968. You can hear the blues influence from their roots, as well as reflections of the late 1960s in their lyrics, politically anyway. Especially in Street Fighting Man, where it talks about political upheavals in London, England, in that year. Although the album was released to positive reviews, this would be the last album for Brian Jones. After enduring more psychological troubles with his drug use, he left the band and would die on July 3rd, 1969, at the age of 27 in the bottom of his swimming pool. It's mysterious how it happened. They never actually found out if he was under the influence of drugs at that time or not, but he just died mysteriously. It's part of that 27 Club with Kurt Cobain, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Brian Jones. 27 is a dangerous age in rock and roll. But the band paid tribute to Jones at their upcoming concert in London's Hyde Park 2 days later. Jones was replaced by Mick Taylor, who helped perpetrate the band to even higher rock stardom. This is where the beginnings of the Rolling Stones' major commercial success would start. But Brian Jones had to die first before they really hit that success they would see in the future. Because the three albums Mick Taylor's featured on, Let It Bleed, Sticky Fingers, and Exile on Main Street, are considered the Stones' best albums. This is their golden age. The next song you're going to hear is off of Let It Bleed, called Gimme Shelter. This song features a female vocalist to really listen out for this song. She really emulates the intensity to the lyrics that deal with the way humans were treating each other back in the late 1960s. Here's Gimme Shelter on Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Treble on Penguin Radio. Thank you.
What's up, y'all? I'm back. This is Bosco with your weekly Bosco Break. The Dominican University of California women's volleyball team was unable to salvage the match of its three-match trip through Hawaii with a tough 3-2 loss to Hawaii Pacific University. The Penguins, currently 3-7 and 0-4 in the PacWest Conference, fell behind in the first set, and that carried over into the second as the Sharks jumped out to a 10-5 lead. Dominican turned the tables with a 6-point run to grab an 11-10 lead. The two teams traded points and Dominican finished set 2 strong. Tied 21-21, Kate Even recorded one of her 6 kills to begin a 4-point run. Even ended it with another kill to even the match at 1 set apiece. The two teams stayed tight throughout set 3 and Dominican trailed 22-20. The Penguins finished strong yet again with a 5-1 run to narrowly take the third set 25-23 and go up in the match 2-1. However, HPU regained the momentum for good in set 4. The Sharks grabbed a 9-4 lead and the Penguins would never get any closer. An early 4-1 deficit put Dominican in another hole in the 5th and deciding set, and the Penguins pulled within a point, 6-5, but tired in the end and fell 15-8. These Lady Penguins now return to the Bay Area and will head to Oakland, California on Saturday, October 3rd at 7 p.m. to face Holy Names. Dominican then returns home to the Collins Center for a 2-match homestand, beginning on Wednesday, October 7th at 7 p.m. versus Academy of Art. Let's get out and show some love for those Lady Penguins. This is DJ Bosco signing out, and you're listening to radio.dominican.edu. You wanna make a point, but you keep preaching.
Identification. Now we pause for station identification. This is Penguin Radio on radio.dominican.edu, the official radio station of Dominican University of California. Currently, you are listening to Let's Rock and Roll, and I'm your host, DJ Treble. This hour, we've been listening and talking all about the Rolling Stones, and it's been great. That last song, Gimme Shelter, reminded me of a movie I saw recently called 20 Feet from Stardom, which talks about the backup singers in a band that are just so close, yet so underappreciated. That female vocalist is featured in that movie. That's a movie I highly recommend checking out. Now, controversy arose in 1969 when the Rolling Stones performed at the Altamont Free Concert at the Altamont Speedway, just 60 miles east from here. Dangerous biker gang Hell's Angels were in charge of being security. The disaster arose when the Angels stabbed and beat to death fan Meredith Hunter after realizing he was armed with a weapon. This incident, including the bloody death, is recorded and featured in the documentary Gimme Shelter about the band up until 1969. I've seen that documentary, and I've seen that scene. It's pretty brutal, not for the faint of heart. Needless to say, the 70s could not have arrived sooner, and we see a change in the Stones, first with forming their own record company, Rolling Stone Records. This newfound creative freedom led to the release of Sticky Fingers in 1971. The album was the first to feature the now-famous Rolling Stones logo on the back of their album cover. The red lips with the red tongue hanging out, you know it, you've seen it everywhere. VH1 would name this the number one greatest album cover of all time. It is undoubtedly the most recognizable logo for any rock band, but the album cover itself, especially on the vinyl, you can actually play with the zipper that appears on the cover, because the album cover is basically a man standing from the waist down, showing his crotch area, and you can actually unzip the zipper on the vinyl record, especially the early ones. But this album was praised for the hits it produced as well, such as Brown Sugar and Dead Flowers. After this release, the Stones would pack their bags and head to France to record their first most successful double album, Exile on Main Street. They left England to basically avoid paying taxes there that they owed the country, so they figured they would just flee to France. If you ask any Rolling Stones fans about this album, many of them will cite Exile on Main Street as their most favorite album of all time. Although it's not my personal favorite, I do commend it for sounding like a piece of art from start to finish, and had the most diverse sounds, blending in various genres into its songs, from country, to rock, to soul, to gospel. That's what the Rolling Stones were definitely based off of, because Charlie Watts, the drummer, was a traditional jazz drummer, while Jagger and Keith Richards were influenced by the blues and soul music. So they had to blend that together along with a bunch of other different sounds to create their own. This album was released in May of 1972, the album hitting number one in the US and UK. The Rolling Stones went on their North American tour in 1972, which is documented in the film Ladies and Gentlemen, The Rolling Stones, released in 1974. Now, I'm a personal fan of watching documentaries that just show live concerts, because it really makes me wish I could transport back in time and be at that concert. This is definitely one of the concerts I wish I could have gone to. The early 1970s were the most commercially successful time for the band, until another period of drugs and legal troubles hit the band, particularly Keith Richards. A warrant was out for his arrest on drug charges in France, and these troubles contributed to the departure of Mick Taylor, the second rhythm guitarist to leave the band. He cited the chaos of the band's drug use affected the creativity and productivity of the band. He also wanted to explore his own creative abilities and felt like the Rolling Stones weren't giving him enough to contribute to. So the Stones auditioned for a new guitarist to complement Richards. They really wanted to stick with the two guitar system for the lead guitarist, but as well as the rhythm guitarist to also blend in with the rhythm section. Some of those who auditioned, and this shocked me when I was looking this up, Peter Frampton and Jeff Beck. At the time, they were relatively unknown guitarists. Well, Jeff Beck was notable for his time in the Yardbirds, but Peter Frampton was merely a guitarist in the band Humble Pie, and he didn't become his own solo artist until the middle to late 1970s, so he was relatively unknown at the time. It baffles me. However, they settled with this little guitarist called Ronnie Wood, who came from the Faces, which is the band that features Rod Stewart on vocals. He joined the Rolling Stones in 1975. Now, he was originally offered the spot in the band a year earlier, but declined due to his ties with the Faces. The Rolling Stones went on tour again in 1975, and would continue the cycle of playing shows and taking drugs, because that's the rock and roll lifestyle. In 1977, Richard's girlfriend, Anita Pallenberg, now this is the same girl that left Brian Jones in Morocco to be with Keith Richards. She had possession of 22 grams of heroin when the Rolling Stones were on tour in Canada, and she stashed it in Keith Richards' hotel room, and he ended up getting caught. For an entire year, this became a huge legal battle, with suspended sentences and parole meetings, all that fun stuff. But the two faced charges and pled guilty for the possession. Because in Canada, when you have a possession of heroin, it's a minimum 7-year sentence at that time. I'm actually not quite sure if that still is, but that wouldn't surprise me. But this incident resulted in Richard's decision to end his relationships with heroin and his girlfriend. When one life ends, another one continues to sail, if you're the case of Mick Jagger. He had just gotten divorced from his first wife, Bianca, and had thrust himself more into the party scene and in the spotlight, specifically Disco Studio 54 in New York City. This was the late 70s, so disco was popping. The late 1970s was the band's first dark period, and they were suffering from disinterest from music listeners due to the popularity of punk rock and disco, all the fads that came in. The Stones made their way back to relevancy and in the hearts of the music critics with their 1978 album, Some Girls, probably my favorite Rolling Stones album of all time. The album reached number one in the US and features songs Miss You, Beast of Burden, and the song you're going to hear next, Far Away Eyes. As I briefly mentioned, the Rolling Stones had influence from the country genre, and many of their songs are considered country or country rock, especially in the late 70s, early 80s. Despite that, I despise country music. I really, really do. The Stones have a knack for creating gems like this song, and older country is actually pretty good, like Hank Williams. But you're going to be listening to Far Away Eyes on Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Treble here on Penguin Radio. I was driving.
Sunday morning through Bakersfield, listening to gospel music on the college radio station. And the preacher said, you know, you always have the Lord by your side. And I was so pleased to be informed of this that I ran 20 red lights in his honor. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Lord. I had an arrangement to meet a girl, and I was kind of late. And I thought by the time I got there, she'd be off with the nearest truck driver she could find. Much to my surprise, girl, with far away eyes.
So if you're down on your luck and you can't harmonize,
find a girl.
It's always a personal favorite of mine. Welcome back to Let's Rock and Roll on Penguin Radio. I'm your host, DJ Treble. After the release of Some Girls, the band would stay afloat with commercial success. However, the relationship between Mick Jagger and Keith Richards would be at its most strained at this point. According to Keith Richards, the two clashed due to Mick's ego and tendency to party more than work. Or at least that's the impression he gives. Keith Richards still considers him an old friend of his, and he always will be a friend of his, but it doesn't help that Richards has a notorious past with drugs. He, as well, can be just as unbearable. I think it's just that sort of relationship. That's what I like to think. It's just two old friends that know each other way too well, yet can't stand to be in the same room. It's very complicated. But as of recent, Richard published his autobiography, Life, in 2010. In which he described Jagger as unbearable. The friendship had been strained for decades. Well, he cleared it up for me. Now I don't need to make assumptions about their relationship anymore. Meanwhile, the band continued to tour the U.S. and released albums as the 1980s arrived. One of their most famous songs, Start Me Up, hit number 2 in the U.S. in 1981. That year, the band also had their most successful tour to date, being the highest-grossing tour of 1981. In 1983, the concert film Let's Spend the Night Together featured the Stones at Sun Devil Stadium in Tempe, Arizona, and in the Meadowlands, New Jersey. The Rolling Stones also toured Europe in 1982 to celebrate their 20th anniversary as a band, as well as sign a four-album, $50 million deal with CBS Records. So far, the Stones were riding high once again. This time, making more money than ever. The turmoil would settle in the mid-1980s. Mick Jagger and Keith Richards practically hated each other at this time, and Jagger wanted to go solo. This left room for the Stones to create material from Keith Richards as well as feature more from Ronnie Wood. Subsequently, Richards became the sole leader of the band and the production of the next few albums. Meanwhile, Jagger would collaborate with David Bowie to cover Dancing in the Street for Live Aid charity movement in 1985. The song hit number 1 in the UK and remains the funniest music video I have ever seen. Seriously, check it out. It's absolutely ridiculous and totally 80s. In 1986, the Rolling Stones were presented with the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award, solidifying their influence on music and the status as legendary. The band then took a break from 3 years due to the tensions of the original founders of the band. That all changed for a brief moment in 1989 when the Rolling Stones, original members and former, were inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. This led Jagger and Richards to set aside their differences to release a new album, Steel Wheels. The single I'll be playing for you next hit number 5 in the US charts. This is called Mixed Emotions, which I believe personifies the relationship between Jagger and Richards and the love and hate that they have for each other, but mostly the love deep down. This is Mixed Emotions on Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Treble. Welcome back, Rolling Stones fans. This is DJ Treble, back with more knowledge of the Stones on radio.dominican.edu. From 1989 to 1991, the Rolling Stones would consistently release albums and go on tours. However, for Bill Wyman, these years would be the end. He officially retired from the band in 1993. Soon after he left, Wyman published Stone Alone, his autobiography based on scrapbooks and diaries he had kept since the early years of the band. The band took a break from producing music together while they were still on a high note, until the release of the 1994 album Voodoo Lounge. The first album without Wyman, the piece is noted for sounding like the Stones from the early 1960s, a common theme for the band to always go back to their roots. The tour that followed became the highest-grossing tour at the time. I keep repeating this, that this is the highest-grossing tour. No, this was the highest-grossing tour. The Rolling Stones were just so successful, and they keep becoming more successful and timeless, that they keep generating more money and keep basically earning more fans. But this tour in 1994 raked in $320 million. Later that year, the Stones released Stripped, a mostly acoustic album that comprises songs that were performed in the Voodoo Lounge, concerts, or rehearsals. This is another favorite album of mine. I'm a general fan of acoustic versions of songs. My favorite is called The Spider and the Fly, an old blues song that really displays Jagger's talent as a vocalist. Look out for this on Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Treble on radio.dominican.edu.
Sitting, thinking, sinking, drinking, wondering what I'll do when I'm through tonight. Smoking, moping, maybe just hoping some little girl will pass on by. I don't wanna be alone, and I love my girl at home. I remember what she said. She said, my, 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 don't tell lies. Keep fidelity in your head. My, 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 don't tell lies. When you're done, your show hit the bed. And don't say hi like a spider to a fly. I jump right ahead and you're dead. So I sit up, fed up, go down, go around, down to the bar and the place I'm at. Sitting, drinking, superficially thinking about the rinsed out blonde on my left. And then I said hi like a spider to a fly, remembering what my little girl said.
Welcome back to Let's Rock and Roll on Penguin Radio. This is your host, DJ Treble. We're wrapping things up here on the second installment of the show tonight. and I thank you all for jamming with me tonight. It's a late start, but hey, it's never too late for some good rock and roll. The Rolling Stones have been a band for over 50 years, and there's no sign of them retiring for good. As we turn into the 21st century aspect of the long history of this band, the Stones released 40 Licks in 2002, a compilation of their greatest hits, to celebrate their 40th anniversary. In 2005, the band released the first album in 8 years, A Bigger Bang. The Rolling Stones, being the big money makers that they are, grossed in $162 million from their performance in Super Bowl 40 in 2006 alone. That was pretty big. Pretty big. Some problems arose during touring in 2006, such as Ronnie Wood's treatment for alcoholism and Jagger's throat problems. Nevertheless, the band performed well enough for Martin Scorsese's documentary Shine a Light, recorded at NYC's Beacon Theater in 2006 and released in 2008. The Stones' Bigger Bang Tour grossed in $558 million, setting a Guinness World Record. Now, my uncle saw the Rolling Stones live during this tour. It was in Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts, and he had tickets all the way in the back. Now, a football stadium, the band center put in the center, and there's a section that is blocked off from behind the band, and then everyone else sits in the back. Well, my uncle had pretty much the cheap seats, could barely see them, could almost barely hear them, too. Gillette Stadium's pretty big. Nevertheless, he can still claim that he saw the Rolling Stones live. I can't. Anyway, 2007 rolled around, and Mick Jagger said in terms of the fate of the band, "I'm sure the Rolling Stones will do more things, more records, and more tours. We've got no plans to stop any of that, really. As far as I'm concerned, I'm sure we'll continue." Mick Jagger would release his fourth studio album in that year, too, so he himself wasn't done for his solo career as well. 5 years after that statement, the Rolling Stones celebrated 50 years as a band by, take a guess, yep, touring. Going on tour, calling it 50 and counting, in which their London shows featured Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton, and Florence Welch from Florence and the Machine. The Rolling Stones, they never cease to amaze me. It's kind of incredible for a band to have such longevity. Now, I know the jokes go around, like, the Rolling Stones are so old. Like, they're just super old. Rock stars can't jam at that age. The members of the band are in their mid-70s, and based on what I've heard, they sound pretty fantastic. So, why quit something you love and just because you're old? Don't do that. No, don't do that. But their tour in 2014 was postponed due to the sudden death of Jagger's longtime girlfriend, Lorraine Scott. Their most recent show, in June of 2014, was performed in Israel, the first time the Stones ever played there, which was described as historic. And that, my friend, is an understatement. The Rolling Stones are historic, without a doubt. The band will forever leave their mark as innovators and creative masters of fusing different genres of music together to create something completely their own. That's one of the reasons I really enjoy this band, because they definitely stand out to me. Like, I can turn on the radio, and I will know instinctively that, oh, that's a Rolling Stones song. Even the most casual rock and roll fan, even a non-rock and roll fan, period, could probably point out who the Rolling Stones are based on what you hear on the radio. That's all for tonight. Don't forget to check out all of our other DJs at radio.dominican.edu. For my shout out tonight, I mentioned earlier in the show about the country songs the Rolling Stones made. But if you want some country appreciation from a bona fide country fan, take a listen to DJ Rodeo Show Country 101, a breakdown of all things country, on Wednesdays from 6 to 7 p.m. I hope you enjoyed this little hour tribute at the Stones tonight. This is DJ Troubles signing off with a song with some wise words from the Rolling Stones off of the Let It Bleed album. You can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, you find you get what you need. I'll see you next week. This is Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu. the official radio station of Dominican University of California. Go Penguins!
Mr. Jimmy, a man